welcome everyone to the Walt Weekly Friday Live. My co-host Walter Latham is on break this week. My co-host for today is Gregory Coleman, engineer at the Walt Weekly and COO of Illumination Media. Today's topic, Universal Basic Income Pros and Cons, brought to you by Soap and Love, Beauty Blends by Ami, Michelle Sweeney here. Our intro and outro music is provided by Uncle Nephew. Joining us is our weekly panel members, Christopher Sweeney out of New Jersey, retired New York sanitation worker and CEO of Johnny Roos Catering. Ernest J. Robinson out of Washington, D.C., Sergeant, U.S. Marine Corps, combat veteran, senior consultant at B. Ernest Leadership and Professional Consultant. Our next weekly panel is Honorable Gene Anthony Edwards, male district leader, 79th District out of the Bronx, New York. We'd like to welcome, as a new panel member, a poet and author, Judy Andrews out of Brooklyn, New York. I will put everyone's social media pages in the chat room. Welcome, members. Today's discussion will be on universal basic income, but right now we want to start off with the breaking news in the George Floyd case. How you guys feel about this new the sentence that he got, Charvin? Greg, you want to start out?
Well, Minnesota judge sentenced Derek Chauvin to 22 and a half years in prison. They were pushing for a 30-year sentence, but the judge sentenced him to 22 and a half years out of a possible 40. So, I really don't have any objection to him getting that 22 and a half years. I didn't realistically think he was going to get it any more than that. And unfortunately, I was almost expecting him to get less, but noteworthy that he got a strong sentence.
Right, but they're saying also that he may only serve 2/3 of it, but he still has pending federal charges.
So yeah, that's what I was going to ask. What happened he still with has that. Federal. Him and the other three officers still have federal charges to face. So we'll see how that turns out.
Yeah, I think those years that he gets, I don't think they're going to be that long, but I think that he will suffer in prison because they're not going to have it. They're not going to have it. I think that the other officers who were with him, they may not get as much time, but I do hope that they are not acquitted because then we will have to be in the streets again.
Definitely.
You know, protesting. But I'm hoping that this sentence sends some kind of message to the police because if we defund the police, there's still going to be an issue because the structure is so intense that if you deal just with one person, it's not enough. It has to be an entire unit across the board in the United States. You know, so I hope this sentence sends a powerful message.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Ernest.
Yeah, I don't think that the message is to be so strong to the police as it should be a message to prosecutors and judges across the country. Because the issues is not necessarily those who violate the laws or rights of others. It's those that don't uphold justice in the court of law. Because, you know, people who are going to break the law, they're going to break the law. But it's up to the judges and district attorneys, prosecutors to being able to uphold the law. And that's what we saw today. That justice was served. Again, to Greg's point, you know, could it have been 40 years, could it have been 60 years, whatever care, but this is a strong, significant sentence. I do agree that yes, it should be a message to other police officers, as Judy had said, that, you know, that you can be held accountable. And I think that this judge has and the prosecution has kind of laid it out as a pathway for this to be mimicked. So this now becomes case law, and like cases that are going to be like it in the future should be held to the same standard.
Absolutely, absolutely. Chris, can you come in to comment about this case, the sentencing, or you busy?
Oh yes. Got a little comment to make about that. And the the people in the cheap seats. I am so happy that I'm so happy that the verdict came down. Well, not the verdict. The judge gave him the 22 and a half years. I do believe he's going to serve some more time with the federal end of it. And it sends a strong message to police officers. We don't want to get rid of you, but if you're not, if you're misbehaving, you're going to pay a price. And that's all we all, that's all people want. They want a fair shot at this.
Right.
You know,
right.
At the end of the day, nobody wants to get rid of the police. We know they serve a purpose. People want to be safe in their communities, but we want to be safe from the police as well. So
right.
Thank God that that came down. Beautiful thing.
Awesome. Thank you for that. Gene?
Yeah, I was basically satisfied. You know, I've seen people get 40 years for, you know, murder too, mm-hmm. which is attempted murder, but right. you know, I wasn't expecting right. him to get the max.
Right.
But I'm pretty much satisfied. You know, 22 and a half, you know, he'll do like 80% of his time. So mm-hmm. he'll probably do like 15 years, but still, that's 15 years in jail. And I tell you what, I couldn't stand 15 seconds in jail, you know?
right.
So
right.
he, and you know, even if he's in protective custody, that's even worse because now you can't even get out and walk around. You got to have, mm-hmm. you know, one, you got to have a CO walk you around the yard for 1 hour a day. Other 23 hours of the day, you are in your cell.
Locked so up, yeah.
He's gonna live. He's living a hell for the next at least 15 years. So I'm satisfied with that.
Awesome.
Hey, Michelle.
Mm-hmm.
Michelle.
Yes.
There was
sir.
One thing I wanted to add, and I don't know if you want to get to it. I know we have a topic to talk about, but
no, we can focus on this right now.
Okay. So I had a little bit of disappointment with the I don't know if everyone heard the mother.
Yes,
of Derek
I was
Schultz.
Gonna speak on her. Yes.
Oh,
go ahead, preach,
okay.
brother. So, go ahead.
Yeah, so it was it's so delusional to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I was growing up, my mother, my grandmother, they loved me to life, right? And God rest my grandmother's soul right now, but who's not with us anymore. But they said if you do something to get yourself in trouble, don't call me if you in jail. Don't
yes.
call.
Yes.
Because you are responsible for your actions. For her to sit there and say that she believes in her son's innocence.
Right.
But then also the audacity to sit there and say how she will not be able to give a special hug or call her, you know, talk to her son on the phone and everything else while another mother and family has lost and daughter who lost
right.
her father who would yes. never be able to see her graduate or her get married or her, you know,
exactly.
have a child or whatever. So the audacity that Derek Chauvin's mother showed in there, I mean, to show the level of insensitivity, the mm-hmm. lack of empathy, and the lack of awareness.
And blaming. Blaming
right.
the media, making them out
right.
to be a monster.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
Right.
I mean, but go ahead.
No,
you said exactly
you
what
know,
I was going to say.
How
yeah.
she was raised.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you know what type of
how
person
he was
she
raised.
Is. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. You took the words right out of my mouth, Ernest. I appreciate that. But yes, it's tragic. And, you know, even on the news, they recognized that every person that was on there, regardless if they were on Chauvin's side or Floyd's side, they all said the same thing, how she focused on her son. And she did not even acknowledge his family, the Floyd family, at all whatsoever.
No. And there's still no remorse from any of them.
None.
They still believe they did nothing wrong. They
right.
still
I
believe
wish they had his
everything
ex-wife
they did through their training.
Can I
yes.
chime in with this? Now she knows what it feels like for us when we get convicted of things that we didn't
there
do.
There you go.
And our mothers are saying, I'm never going to be able to hold my son again, or
right.
somebody's son is murdered. Now she knows what that feels like and what that looks like.
Exactly.
Well, I would caveat that because there's a lot more black men who go to jail for things that they really did not do.
That's right.
You can't hold and touch your son. This dude was a cold-blooded murderer.
Yes.
And for her to even to describe how caring and how big of a heart he has and all of these things, again, was just so disillusional. But I understand the sentiment, Chris, that you were saying about the fact that, yeah, despite right, wrong, or indifferent, he's still going to jail.
I was putting it out there like that because so many times when we are innocent and our son is that good person, but he's sent to jail and no sympathy is given.
Right.
You know, that's how I meant it. Like,
right. I got you.
He needs to go to jail. He deserves it. And if she's delusional and she wants to be delusional and they're looking to blame, because that's all they want to do, is no accountability. Right. Well, there is accountability. The judge handed it down. You want to go hug your son? Go visit him.
There you go.
Right.
For that 1 hour he'll have, right?
If that, but yeah.
Yeah, if that. Even if he probably won't even get visitation. You know? That's crazy. But, you Man. Know, exactly. That's bottom line. Like, it is what it is. You got an hour, buddy. You got to pick and choose wisely what you're going to do with that 1 hour. But, you know, even if it was, I saw a young lady on the news after the, you know, she was crying, hysterical, saying that, you know, if that was us, there would have been more time. You know, if it was a black person that did that, they would have got the maximum time, you know, 30. I mean, we go to jail for a joint. You know, possession at the, you know, for many years back in what, the 80s, they were just arresting us and they gave us higher, more sentencing than a white person would for a drug charge, which is for anything. It just doesn't have to be a drug charge. It could have been anything. We got more time than they would serve. So
I almost think that if you were to kill a police officer, you would actually go to jail for capital murder.
Right.
Yeah.
Which in most states carries a death sentence. And I think that now don't want to insinuate or infer that if, you know, there's a justified homicide by a police officer to a civilian, that they should automatically get capital murder. But I think that if a murder is not a justifiable homicide, but if a murder is to be found, just like Derek Chauvin was, I think that a capital murder sentence or judgment or verdict should be what is rendered. So it should carry the same weight as a civilian were to kill a police officer, because that is unjust, right? Because that wouldn't be justifiable homicide. And I think if a police officer murders a civilian where there is no justifiable homicide, it should be a capital murder just the same.
Right. I think also, you know, the police have this clause, you know, in their union, you know, which is called qualified immunity. And if they have qualified immunity, which is why we want this idea of defunding the police to be important and to be passed through, if they have qualified immunity, that means that they can't get a lawyer and have the union back them at the same time and support their case if they're in an incident of police brutality. So they want to take that away from them because right now they have that. And that's what Mr. Chauvin's lawyer was trying to prove, you know, that this was because of his training. This is why he committed this act. But without qualified immunity, they would have thrown the case out right away and he would have been sentenced a long time ago. So that's one aspect of defunding the police that we really need to pass through.
Judy, I agree with you. I think that's one of the institutions really that has to be attacked on so many different fronts, that concept of qualified immunity. That's going to, in so many states and so many jurisdictions, you know, there's different ways where they implement that, but that's what has to be attacked next. Qualified immunity has to be gotten rid of. When you look, as far as anything is concerned, this man was found guilty of murder. He's a criminal. Mm-hmm. And treat him and sentence him as such. Plain and simple.
Right. And to piggyback.
The sympathies from his mom. Go ahead.
No. I was just going to say, to piggyback that qualified immunity, that is what is really got them up in arms. And that's why they're pushing so hard and trying to make it seem like you want to defund the police and get rid of the police, because mm-hmm. they want to protect that qualified immunity.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I think that the term defund the police should be, I think we need, they need to coin a different term, because again, we're not trying to get rid of the police. We're trying to redistribute how the police is funded, that in most cases militarizes the police, and redistribute those funds within the community in order to being able to support healthy community policing. You know, other agencies, Department of Social Services, and ancillary support that police need, that the community needs in order to keep the community safe, versus again militarizing the police to do X, Y, and Z things that they don't need to be doing. And so, but the term itself has such a negative connotation on both sides, on those who are trying to protect the police and on the side of those who want to quote unquote defund the police, because they think it's all about, you know, getting rid of police. And that's not what's being advocated for, or should not be what's advocated for, because despite anything, we still need police. We need fire department. We need emergency responders. And there's no mitigating that. Like we need those things, but we need to do it smartly and structured.
Awesome. Appreciate that. So we're going to move on to our topic today, guys. Universal basic income, also called unconditional basic income, citizens' basic income guaranteed, or like a living stipend. So, Greg, I'm going to hand this over to you. You have the questions for the panel. You can start with that, and we'll get into universal income. You there, Greg?
Yeah, I'm going to touch on it, briefly. The concept mm-hmm. of universal basic income isn't mm-hmm. a new concept. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's been around for centuries. But what thrusted it back into a national conversation was presidential candidate Andrew Yang's assertion that increasing automation and the use of artificial intelligence is eliminating American jobs at an alarming rate. Mm-hmm. That was primarily the backbone of his campaign. With so much attention going to the front runners of both parties, universal basic income kind of got lost in the conversation. It didn't get as much attention as it deserved because of the dramatics going on during the presidential season. We want to take a deeper look on the Walt Weekly at with our panelists at exactly what universal basic income is.
But you know, when he was running for president back in 2019, he did an interview with USA Today, and I was reading that he said that if he could have this kind of forward-thinking movement where he would give $1,000 a month to every American, it would eliminate a lot of poverty in the country. There are 34 million Americans today, as well as in 2020 and 2019, who, you know, were poor, who could not afford anything. So he feels that if you could have $1,000 a month, you would feel less stressed. In the interview, he was explaining you would be able to function, you could do the things that you love and deal with the dreams that you have for your future. If you're in college, many of the jobs, you know, have disappeared. And one of the reasons DT, or I really hate to say his name, but one of the reasons Donald Trump got elected was because these people thought that he would bring back, you know, coal mining and, you know, jobs where you're working with your hands and you're working, you know, on
you're working on items where you don't have to use a computer or technology. Right. But technology is really replacing, you know, AI technology is really replacing many of the jobs that people used to do, from the airport to cashiers to even teachers. You know, you can go online and go to school and get a degree. So maybe, I don't know if $1,000 would be even enough. And that he wanted to tax the rich so that, you know, the money, when asked by a reporter who was interviewing him, he asked him, well, where is this money going to come from if you have trillions of dollars coming out of the government? Where really is the government, is this coming from? And of course, Mr. Yang was saying, well, you know, you could tax the wealthy, you know, the people who own companies like Uber and, you know, Amazon, Target, all of these companies where their CEOs and COOs are billionaires. When they pay their taxes, which they don't pay that much, we've learned from the former president, they don't pay that much.
Exactly.
That money could come from the taxes. So, you know, that could be a great idea. But then you have the other issue of welfare, because once you pay, if you paid me $1,000 a month when I was right out of college, I wouldn't be looking for a job. I would be trying to hang out. I mean, I wouldn't even want to hang out, but I would really use the money the way that a 20 something would use the money.
Rather than
someone who's older. So it has the pros and the cons, but I still believe in the idea personally. I think that it could help a lot of people because there are a lot of people who are suffering.
I appreciate that. Ernest, you want to elaborate on that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't think there's any perfect system. I think the idea is a very, I think it's a good idea. I think that one, I think sometimes we misconstrue taxes and funding from the government and don't understand that they're almost one and the same, because the government is funded by taxes, by our tax dollars. And in different ways, taxes, you know, go to different entities, but it's still all, so we'll pay more. So the rich will pay more. And those taxes will go to redistribute the wealth. And that's another term of actually redistribution of wealth, really, is by giving $1,000. I think that there are people, no matter how much money that they make, are going to be bad with money. So whether you make a lot of money, people are bad with money. And whether you make a little bit of money, people are bad with money. I can concede that the concept of one, the economy being able to sustain itself, because all of that money would actually recycle. So if you're bad with money, you get an extra $1,000. Well, that's another $1,000 that's going back into the economy.
Because
that's staying in your pocket and it's not appreciating anywhere else. It's going back into the economy. If you're able to, you know, pay your bills and everything else, that's still helping the economy, because every time you pay your water bill and all your utilities, and you're maintaining your mortgage, you're helping out the banks, you're helping out percentage rates, you're helping out the city with paying your utilities. So there's a tremendous upside if that $1,000 was there. I think it would, in some cases, it might be able to prevent some crimes. In some cases, it may increase more crimes because now people know you got more money. There's a give and take with it all, but I think there's more of an upside to actually having it than not having
it. I agree. And I think it would limit crime, because, you know, people who are desperate, if you are desperate and you don't have any food, you're the place that you live in is in squalor, you're going to do whatever you can to make a buck. You know, that's why a lot of people turn to drug dealing, because it's easy money and you can get it. It's dangerous money, but you can make a lot of money doing it. So giving someone $1,000 a month who does not have to pay a lot of rent, or someone who doesn't have to go to a job that's going to stress them out, would definitely improve their living standard. you know. Right. So I agree with it. I just don't know how it would actually be done in America because, you know, there's just so many, you know, things that could go wrong.
Right.
Oh, actually, there was something else I wanted to add. So that, and because Judy brought a point about, you know, low income housing. Mm-hmm. So I used to work in social services, and that, and I knew some of our clients that came in, their rent was only $10 a month. I mean, that was their whole rent. And a lot of them, and many of them lived off of SSI or SSD, and that's Social Security Income or Social Security Disability, and also received food stamps. And so in some cases, for those who are trying to save cash, because a lot of times their Social Security would be taken for their rent and they pay $10 in cash, or sometimes it would be or they just had enough to being able to maybe pay their car note or pay something else. So if they did have $1,000 and there was, let's say, and many times there are single moms, mothers who are subjected to this kind of living. But if she were able to receive an extra additional $1,000 a month, realistically, she'll be able to save that money over periods of time and be able to move out of that project area, because she would have the resources to do so. For your regular average family that's making, you know, anywhere from you know, $50,000-$60,000 to your $120,000, an additional $1,000 a month is, you know, dance lessons. It's a you know, small vacation for the family. It's books for their kids that are in college. You know, so I think there's, again, a tremendous upside despite the socioeconomical differences between families that there can be. I don't know, maybe I don't know if the voting is done in New York yet. If y'all got Mayor Yang to get in there.
No, he's good. No, Eric Adams.
I know. All right.
So. And Curtis Sliwa, Guardian Angel. Oh boy, that's gonna be a trip. He had Giuliani backing him, so we'll see how that goes. So
here's one of the things I wanted to touch on and ask, you know, definitely among the panelists. Mm-hmm. Is would universal basic income be considered a form of welfare? And I want to start, Gene, how do you feel about that? Gene, you still with us?
Yeah, I'm here. You know, when capitalism was started, you know, it was basically meant for there to be a caste system. You know, middle class wasn't really created. It was like wealthy and then the poor. And I remember, you know, my mother gave me a book when I was a younger man called Regulate the Poor. And it was talking about, you know, FDR and the, you know, Great New Deal and things of that nature. And, you know, so when I see UBI, I just think about the Great New Deal and how America created a middle class for white people. So if there's a way to create a middle class for, you know, people of color, then I'm all with it. You know, that's how I feel about it. But understanding capitalism, somebody has to be at the bottom. So to me, you know, the lazy people or the people that are unlearned because they want to remain unlearned, you know, they'll remain at the bottom. But if we could create a middle class for, you know, people of color, then I'm not against it.
Okay.
How about you, Chris?
Well, first, let me say it's the one thing that would damage a capitalist society, right? Because, as Gene says, there needs to be poor. There needs to be a class system here in order for capitalism to excel, right? I do think that it's something that could work, right? But we are so conditioned. As Americans in this country, we feel sorry for big business before we'll feel sorry for each other. Oh, why should the big business have to pay the extra taxes? You know, we'll find so many other reasons other than why it would work for us.
we would it would get defeated by us before it even got anywhere, because people would argue against it, like they have been. When they gave the rich, the uber rich, the tax breaks and the cuts, and they were like a thousand times before, they were expected to trickle down, and it never trickles down. People forget that, but people fought hard for companies and big conglomerates to get tax breaks over. But if you told somebody, well, somebody's going to get an extra $50 in their welfare, they lose their minds. Oh, these people are lazy. They don't want to work. They'll find so many other reasons to fight against helping themselves. So to get this, the people in this country to change their mindset and really look at it, because like you said, if you had an extra $1,000 a month coming into a family, into a household where they're living in public housing, now they can work themselves into getting out of public housing. And that family in turn is now not stressing the system and is actually saving money. But if you look at it that way, objectively, you know, nothing's perfect. It's going to have some hiccups. It's going to have some things that we got to work through. But the thought, if you really think about it, is something that can work. We just got to get our minds wrapped around helping us before we help the rich.
Absolutely.
Okay. And that kind of leads me into my next question.
Hold on, Greg.
Yeah. Go ahead, Ernest.
Yep. Because what I wanted to do for the people is I wanted to define welfare to answer your question, okay? And it's the statutory procedure or social effort designed to promote the basic physical and material well-being of people in need. And in North America, it's the financial support given to people in need. So the thing about it is that the people in need actually does not distinguish their social economical status, because those big banks and the automotive industry were considered to be in need, and where they receive government subsidized funding to being able to sustain their businesses. So they were in need.
Corporate welfare.
Yes, right. Absolutely. And so I think to Chris's point about fixing our mindsets, that we have to get past the fact of what we consider to be in need, and not that it's only those who make less than, you know, $15,000 or, you know, whatever have you. Yes, they're below what's considered to be the poverty line. But what is in need is every family is somewhat in need. I mean, you got two working adults in a household, wherever it can be, you work, you know, 60 hours a week, you got $120,000, but you're paying, you know, almost $60,000 a year in your rent or your mortgage, and you got to try to eat and everything else, and gas is $3 and probably somewhere in New York is $3.54 a gallon or whatever the case may be. And, you know, and you're in need. So I think that, again, Chris hit the point, and I wanted to define what welfare is so that people can get past the fact and stop looking down on other people who might be in need. And I think to address your question, would it be considered welfare? By definition, yes, it would be considered welfare. And would there be a statutory limit to, you know, how much a person can make before they would, you know, qualify outside of that realm? That possibly would happen.
But Ernest, how many people had no problem bailing out the auto industry, giving them welfare?
You're absolutely right.
We had people, regular people, advocated for that because we understood the enormity of those companies going under, how many people it would affect globally. So we understood that. We just need to learn to understand that if we helped each other the same way, it's the same effect. We got to wrap our head around that.
Great point. Yeah, how about you, Judy? Right.
Yes, even everyone who's paying taxes, the tax-paying population, they receive an earned income credit every year. But it's based on your gross salary. So you have to fit a certain line or baseline in order to be able to receive it. So welfare everybody's going to be getting it. So it's not like, you know, this universal basic income would be given to every American. If that's the case, every American can still prosper, whether or not they are lazy, quote unquote, or whether or not they can use that money to save later on in life. It would still help so many people. There are always going to be, this is a capitalist society, as Gene said, and there's always going to be people who are down on their luck and can't see a way out and are hopeless. But if you give them a little hope, you know, someone who can get that much money can maybe look for the future or look toward the future. Not everyone in the projects wants to just hang out. People really want to, you know, live a better life. And they're always searching to find a way to live a better life. So it's not a handout. And that's the problem with Reaganomics. You know, he began this idea of the welfare queen. And, you know, there's this idea that, which is what Republicans now use to avoid having any kind of program that helps an American. They believe you want a handout. You want to pull yourself up by the, you know, you've got to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Well, you know, in reality, people just want to live better. They want to be able to provide for their families, have some type of education, and move on to buy something or live a quality of life that, you know, celebrates them. So any amount of money would really be helpful. Not everyone is going to, you know, lay back and say, well, I'm not going to work. I'm just going to do what I want to do. I think that once they get that, they will find other ways. And we always, because we're a capitalist society, we always have that criminal element that's there. And it's a given because of human nature. But the majority of people really want to live a better life. That's what I really think. And, you know, they want to live that unreachable dream that only maybe 1% of people really ever get in this country. So giving $1,000 a month is a good thing. Everyone will get it, but there are going to be problems. But I don't think it would be bad to have that money.
Okay. And like you said, I agree that earned income credit is almost, in another way, some form of universal basic income. I think that's the in another form. And
right.
that leads me to, do you think as a society, we should be eliminating those stigmas that we place on the categories of capitalism and socialism, and should there be some type of middle ground? I know, you know, the arguments on both sides of universal basic income are, you know, one, it's capitalist, the other, you know, it's socialist. We're a capitalist society and this is too socialist. But do you think there should be some middle ground between that capitalism and socialism labels? Ernest, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, it's called America. Because to the point, there are some things that we do that would be considered socialist. And some things that we do where we're more capitalistic about. The middle ground is the simple fact that we're able to have both being able to coexist. We have a government that provided subsidies for the uber rich, has provided subsidies for the most in need and poor, well below the poverty line. And that's how we have been able to exist and operate for decades, if not much longer than that. I think what happens is that we take one particular program, if it happens to benefit this particular group more than another group, then now it becomes more, we're not going to be a socialist, country. Then that's not who we are, because no one's ever stopped anyone from being able to make money. Just because you happen to being able to provide a social program or some outreach effort for a particular demographic that's in need. So, I mean, and so that goes from the farmers who receive subsidies all the time. That's welfare. That's a socialist program. And so the same people that tout all of these particular talking points and misconstruing words and perverting definitions really need to just become more educated and more aware and realize that that we are in a cohabitating for lack of better words where we're in a society where it coexists, where socialists and capitalists coexist to where it's really the definition of America.
How about you, Shell?
Well, I want to say I'm a proud retiree from a socialist program. I work for the city. I'm paid by the taxpayers. I mean,
you're right.
It's the truth.
Yeah.
That's a socialist program. Mm-hmm. And so many people, police officers, firefighters, EMS, EMT, sanitation, transit, those are all benefiting from a socialist program. And people don't even, so they're out there arguing for something, against something. Really, they're arguing against themselves because that's what's feeding you.
And teachers. I have a pension. Yeah. Thank God. You know.
Hey, Chris. Chris. This is how they mask the different departments that you mentioned. This is how they mask it being a socialism. They call it a municipal job. You know, like you're working for a municipality. You know, being a city worker.
Well, I'm absolutely. It's taxpayer money paying for these services.
I get a. A monthly paycheck from the Veterans Association, and you can't get any more socialist than that. And I don't have any problem with it. So,
yeah. And a matter of fact,
again, it's making people understand how the system works. They really don't understand how they are and how they play into the system. You're a part of the system, and you don't even know how it works for and against you. It's just amazing.
Yeah, I mean, and Chris is hitting right on the head. Like, that's, we really, I mean, and I'm grateful to Walt that we have this podcast, and I hope there's other podcasts that are out there that kind of shed light on these particular topics, because we need to talk about this more even within our own communities, because a lot of people feel shame when it comes down to getting food stamps or any particular being on any welfare assistance or workforce development plans or et cetera, and not understanding that that's what it's there for, you know.
Exactly.
And so we've all used and or benefit from it in some way, shape, form, or fashion. And ultimately, if we're able to make you, me, a better man, a better woman for what it is that we do individually, we'll end up making our communities better in the long run. And so, again, both socialist and capitalistic programs exist in the United States of America. America's not a monolith. And, you know, that everyone's keep using that word for the last 2 years. even our economic system is not monolithic in its approach. And they've both been able to succeed successfully. Without compromise of the other. So we're able to have welfare programs, which we consider socialist, and we're able to, and everyone's able to be entrepreneurs or, you know, CEOs of whatever particular companies and make as much money as their heart so desires.
But there are many people out there who don't want to see $1,000 a month help a family because it eliminates revenue for them. People make Correct. Money off of other people's suffering.
Yes.
You know, Correct. When you have people, $1,000 could, you know what that can change, how that can change the mental health of people in this country? And you know how much money they make off people being mentally disturbed or depressed or whatever? So, you know, there's always going to be people against these things because they profit from suffering in this country.
And that kind of leads in.
And just think of the.
Go ahead, Judy.
No. Oh, no, I was just going to say, and just think of the people who in Miami who have no place to live now. They have no place to live. These are whole families who have nowhere to go, no place to live. They have to start. They lost everything when that building caved in, when that building will, I don't know what to say about it, but when it caved in. They have nothing, nowhere to go, the people who survived. So wouldn't a program like, you know, universal basic, you know, income help people like that? That's what it's there for. That's, you know, that's what, quote unquote, the welfare program is there for.
How many people in that building were probably against it? Until you need it, you don't know that you need it.
That's very true. That is very true.
So if the people are the ones to gain, the people as in a whole, as a whole, would gain from a UBI system, who's the section of society that would lose? Who are these people that say they would there would be something lost in implementing a universal basic income course system?
Greedy rich. People. I don't even think
the very wealthy. Mm-hmm.
But they won't be affected because, again, people are going to spend their money,
put it back into
society. It's going to recycle. It's just people who are there's a difference between wealthy people and greedy people. Mm. And there are people out there that just are greedy. Mm-hmm. It's never enough money for them.
Yep. Certainly. That's true.
You got any insight on that, Gene?
Correct. Greedy people.
yeah. I think the wealthy, especially the corporations, they would do well because, you know, with people at a lower income getting that boost, you know, every month, all they're going to do is run to Target and Walmart, like Ernest said, and they're going to give it right back. They're not going to invest in index funds or anything like that because they haven't been taught how to make their money work. So
right.
I think the economy is going to have a boost. You know, I mean, Hennessy, you know, you need to invest your stock in Hennessy if they come out with this UBI. They're going to make some money.
They're going to make a lot of money, so, Hennessy and Nike.
Yeah. Well, that's where education would come in. You really would have to start teaching people, you know, how to invest. And, you know, you really need to do that when they're in high school or elementary school. They need to learn it. You know, I didn't really learn it until I was in my 20s that, yeah, I better, you know, put some money into that TDA instead of just spending my entire check on a Gucci bag. You know, it's important for you to learn the different, you know, the stock market. You need to know about dividends. You need to know about appreciation, depreciation. Those are terms that are not really taught in school or until you get into college. So maybe, you know, through education, maybe in a math class in elementary school, you know, there are some schools that are doing it, you know, where the kids are investing in the stock market and they need to understand the trends of the stock market. But there are different, you know, ways of earning wealth that children need to be taught, you know, how to buy a house. You know, what do you need to do in order to buy a house? Do you know you need to have a mortgage evaluation? You need to go, you know, and apply for a loan. How do you go about and get a loan? How do you go about?
You already know society is not going to teach us that because they don't want us to grow. So you have to teach it, you know, from what you learn. You pass it down to your children or your nieces and nephews or family members to let them know. We have to teach ourselves. You know, that's
and it comes with a business mind.
Yeah, they don't want us to be successful. So we have to learn our Black history on our own.
I think and the same, you know, just like you said, Shell, I mean, you can definitely compare it to Black history because I don't think we should leave it up to society.
Exactly.
That's something that we have to do on our own.
Right.
We can't wait for the folks that we say victimize us to teach us. We have to take the initiative and learn that. And I think, you know, that's kind of where I come from with my next question, something that speaks to the heart and the philosophy of the people. And is it the obligation of the government to take care of the less fortunate or a responsibility of the people? And I want to ask every one of you that and get your take on that. Judy?
I think that it's both. I think we need to be able to help people who cannot help themselves for whatever reason. And we also need to lift. We need, if we've done something great and we've been able to be successful, we should pass that on, you know, and not get so upset like, oh, well, who does she think she is? Just be, you know, she thinks she's better than us. We need to get rid of that mentality and go out and really begin to help others. And it can be done, and it is done. It is being done. But we really need to focus on how we can help our families. It starts with the family. And if the family can't do it, then it starts with the help that we get from an organization or the government or a neighbor or someone who is doing better. And that's the way it's always been in the African American community. We lifted each other up. And now because of, I hate to say this, but I think it's true, because of integration, we have fallen by the wayside and everyone is out for themselves. But when we were together with those, you know, in those Black towns or in those Black communities, everyone looked out for each other. And I think we need to go back to that and start doing that again. It is happening, but in very small amounts, in very small communities around the country.
I agree. It takes a village, Judy. Definitely. Yes. We have to teach. Right. We have to stick within our community, help our community, and teach our children. You know, my son is a perfect example. I made a lot of financial mistakes growing up. You know, I made some decent money, didn't do smart things with it. And at my age now, I'm seeing more, and I can teach my son more, where he can learn from my mistakes and don't make the same decisions that I make. Think about it. Do your own research on top of it. Don't take my word for it. But, you know, he had a hard lesson he learned dabbling in Bitcoins, you know, didn't listen, and he lost. So that's his first, you know, his first loss of money, you know, at his age. But he learned from it. As long as you learn from it and you grow from it, it helps. But it does take a village. You know, we have to teach. And, you know, even if you're just talking to somebody, you know, that you meet off the street, just, you know, if you start a conversation, you're talking about finance, just give that person, you know, information. You learn something new every day. So sharing and caring, you know, means a lot in our community.
Yeah. And when I was in college, they, you know, people like American agencies, companies like American Express and all of the credit card companies would actually show up on career night. And offer us these cards. And you're like, you get your first credit card at 18.
Lost your damn mind.
You're in debt by the time you're 21.
Right. Vulture.
So we have to teach our kids about credit. You got to teach them about credit.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. Yeah. That's right. That's right.
How about you, Ernest?
Okay, Ernest. Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with what Judy has said. I think it's both. And I think that the way that we should look at our communities, our elected officials should be representative or indicative of what our community, reflective of what our communities look like. So it should be somebody from our community that is our elected official, that speaks and votes on behalf of us. But we should engineer, put together the drafts and proposals for whatever particular bills that we want to be laid out that's going to help govern us. So we should be self-governing in such a way that, you know, that the elected officials in a community are synonymous. To your point about, you know, whether it's history, whether it's financial literacy, no, there should not be a government entity that should tell us how, when, and where to being able to do that. I think we should have take much more initiative and be much more intentional about how we educate ourselves and our community as a whole. And something that remains consistent is why we oftentimes get so caught up in the feeling of sharing and the notion of educating one another, but we won't endure and do it constantly, consistently, grooming somebody else to come behind us. You know, there was a point in time where we did not have internet. And we did not have books. It was the elders who would tell the stories. And I'm talking about back in Africa and back during slavery. You know, when we didn't have a whole bunch of books and we didn't have a whole bunch of stuff. But it was the stories and the lessons that were being taught. And we have so many tools that we should be doing such a much better job at being able to teach and reach those that need it the most. But again, the short answer is, yeah, it's both. It's both the community, it's both the people, as well as the elected officials that have the responsibility. But the elected officials should be reflective of our community.
Absolutely.
Well, is that really how it is? Like, let's look at how the the tax dollars is distributed, right? New York, California, big states pay high taxes. A large chunk of that money is divided and divvied up into places like Kentucky, Tennessee, you know, Tennessee, all of these places that don't generate that much income and tax, right? And tax revenue. But yet, the way the electoral system is set up, as far as voting, they get a louder voice than we do, and our money is funding it. So it's crazy how that system works, right? You know, you're putting your money into a system, you should have a say. But because we are a bigger state, right, and we have more people, they had to try to make it a little bit fair. But yet my money is funding ideas that I don't agree with. So it's already happening, right? So it has to be up to the people to regulate it, because government doesn't work when it, in that regard. I just tried to make I don't know if I made that example clear to everybody, but, you know, it doesn't really work that way.
Well, you definitely explained the scenario.
Mm-hmm.
So how about you, Gene? Our government official, is it the obligation of the government to take care of the people and the less fortunate, or is it the responsibility of the people? Or is it a combination of them both?
It's a combination of both. You know, people have to seize the opportunities that are out there. You know, like, for instance, in New York State, if you live in New York State, you can go to college. You could go to a state college for free. And, you know, I don't see many people taking advantage of that. Well, people of color, I'm talking about Black people, taking advantage of that, you know. And then they have subsidies for the city universities as well. And I see more people going to city universities. So, you know, that's a good thing, I guess. But I always looked at, you know, college, the type of school you go to will determine the type of career path you have. So, for instance, you know, students that go to city universities, they basically get trained to have city jobs. Like, you know, like Chris said, whether it's sanitation, police, school teachers, et cetera. People that go to state universities, they get groomed to be the supervisors of these said, you know, city jobs. And students that go to private institutions, they normally do better and get jobs that put them in the upper middle class. But as far as the government's responsibility, I use FDR and the Great New Deal as an analogy. You know, if the President of the United States could create an entire economy for white people to take them, you know, from poverty and make them middle class and give them land and things of that nature, then, yeah, it is a responsibility of the government simply because it's been done before.
Well, you definitely bring up something, Gene, you know, when it comes to, you know, the educational aspects of it, that I'd love to have set aside a show just for that discussion, because I think it definitely needs to be had. But I appreciate everybody on these questions and their insight. Michelle?
Awesome, Greg. Awesome. Yes, I pretty much agree with everything everyone said. It is a responsibility for both. So, everyone, we're going to close it out early, if everybody's okay with that. Anyone else has anything, any final words they would like to contribute to this today's podcast before I go into my closing?
This is a great topic, and we really need to discuss it even more.
Yeah, we'll definitely discuss
Thank
it
you.
Even more. Yeah, we don't have a lot of time, but we can always come back to this in the future. Yeah, thank you, guys.
Yes.
So, thank you all. I want to thank my co-host, Greg Coleman.
Hold on. I have okay. Michelle, I have one thing to
hold
call
on, hold
up.
On. Good. Uh-oh. I love it. Go ahead. Go ahead, G.
You know, this one is going to, you know, touch people a certain kind of way. But, you know, like I always say in my closing arguments, I'm going to speak the truth, and I don't care, you know, who doesn't like it or nor how they're affected by it. When it comes to UBI and the government's responsibility and things of that nature, back in like 1970, after the Vietnam War, the government started giving subsidies to black women with the caveat that the black man couldn't be in a household. Mm-hmm. And that's where the welfare queen was born. So right now I'm talking to black men. Nobody's coming to save you. You're going to have to go out there and get it yourself legally, because if you're in jail, you're no help to anyone in your family. But black men, nobody's going to come and save you. The black woman could always get saved, you know, by the government. But black men, nobody's coming to save you. You're going to have to go out there and get it. If it means you have to go to school at night, take online classes while you're working two jobs, do what you have to do to establish yourself in this society. And just remember, nobody's going to come and save you. That's all.
That's right. And black men at the time took care of their family. It's just a recent phenomenon that you have so many African-American men who are in jail, who are going down a system, you know. So we have to get rid of that stereotype, because there are black men out there taking care of their business.
There you go.
They're doing it.
There you go.
Amen.
Amen to that. Yes. Thank you, everybody. Okay. Up next, next week, Wednesday, June 30th, we have a special release at 3 p.m.
We got a big one.
A big one. We have a candid interview with Walter Latham.
Oh, yeah.
That name is familiar, right? Who is the king of comedy.
Comedy, yes.
And producer of Kings and Queens of Comedy. He is, yes, my co-host's son, Walter Latham Sr. So, So he's a producer, creator of King and Queens of Comedy and the Bad Boys of Comedy. That will run, we will rebroadcast it again on Sunday. So we will not have a Friday Live next week due to celebrating the 4th of July holiday. So thank you, everyone. Thank you, Greg, for being my co-host today. Thank you, Walter, for being in the background. I hope you had a great break. Thank you to our live audience for joining, and our weekly panel, Ernest, Greg, Chris, Christopher, Jean, and Judy. Thank you for your expertise on our topics that we have weekly. We appreciate you guys. You can find us at thewaltweekly.com. We're on IG and Facebook, The Walt Weekly, Twitter, Walt Weekly, Podbean, The Walt Weekly, iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Pandora, and other streaming platforms. We appreciate you guys. Have a safe and awesome holiday week. If you're traveling, be safe. Enjoy it. Thank you all. Have a great night.
Thank you. Thank you. Same here to you.
Blessings, everybody.
Night, everybody. Thank you. Have a great
week. Good night. Good night.